This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we try to estimate the effect of this year's Port Townsend Film Festival being the first without a special guest, and we reprise a portion of KPTZ's live two-hour broadcast last weekend from the 40th annual Port Townsend Wooden Boat Festival. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
Despite the lack of a big-name special guest as in years past, this month's 17th annual Port Townsend Film Festival will be a special event, according to Jeanette Force, the festival's executive director.
The depth of engagement for our festival is evolving, and because of that, we've evolved from, oh, please come to our tiny festival, to what other opportunities are presenting themselves. And I love that level of agility and creativity. But it's very different than saying we have one person that people should care about and then a bunch of random independent films. We've got brilliant independent films.
It's been a yearly occurrence how a special guest is secured, usually in the spring, with three teaser clues published. The first person to correctly guess the guest's identity gets to take a picture with them for their scrapbook. This year, however, the possibilities kept disappearing.
We had some wonderful conversations with William H. Macy, who was eager to attend. Then his television show was renewed, and he wasn't able to be with us. Bruce Dern is a perfect example. While Bruce was here, he suggested some other people that would love to come to our festival, and we contacted one of those, and that person was eager to attend. Unfortunately, at the ninth hour, they had the opportunity to appear in another major motion picture.
Guests in the past have included Elliot Gould, Bruce Dern, Karen Allen, Beau Bridges, Chris Cooper, Cloris Leachman, Malcolm McDowell, and John Sayles. Most are older veterans of the film business and are past their commercial prime, but by no means down for the count. Dern, 2012 special guest, went directly from the festival to film Nebraska, for which he earned an Oscar nomination.
The criteria for a special guest is someone who can inform our audiences in a professional way that they might not experience anywhere else.
As a reporter for the Peninsula Daily News, I interviewed the last six special guests. Dern was my favorite. I had a list of questions but didn't get to ask them beyond what his expectations were for the festival. At that point, he treated me to an expletive-ridden 35-minute monologue about his life and career. Beau Bridges was the most difficult. He wouldn't schedule an advance time, so I had to walk around town with a list of questions and a notebook in my pocket, ready to go at any time. When he called late on a Sunday afternoon, he told me he had about 5 minutes to spare after I was promised 15, so I muddled through. Upon meeting him, I learned about his competitive streak, which led me to believe he was testing me, and I most certainly failed. In 2013, Karen Allen proved to be open, friendly, and a little reckless. One afternoon, she went into the pin bar to sign the front of a Raiders of the Lost Ark pinball machine. This caused members of her entourage and festival management to turn white as she crawled on top of the machine to get the correct angle. Allen is returning this year as a filmmaker, showcasing her new movie, A Year by the Sea. She is taking up some of the celebrity slack and, to Force's amazement, actually asks whether she could attend this year's event. While so-called big-name guests sell some passes, Force said that many of the attendees are more interested in the nuts and bolts of filmmaking, like sound and cinematography. This year, the focus has shifted toward those topics and others. Force isn't sure how well it will work, although passes are selling at a rapid clip.
So it's hard to say what's random interest and what is really driving our patrons. The surveys do not indicate I attended your festival because I could meet Tony Curtis.
While many of the screenings and forums are geared toward professional filmmaker, the community can join in. Each night, the public is invited to sit on hay bales on Taylor Street, watching a family-friendly movie on a giant inflatable screen. This year, the featured films are Field of Dreams, Toy Story, and Raiders of the Lost Ark, which Alan, a star of the film, will introduce. Another highlight is when a special guest meets with high school students to talk about the movie business and answer questions. At these events, they field queries that would not be asked in a so-called professional context, so it differs from the average interview. This year, Alan and actor Andrew Perez speak about the art of acting. It takes place at 1:40 p.m. on September 23rd in the high school auditorium, 1500 Van Ness Street, and is open to the public. For a long time, our society has taught us that bigger is better, that real life only exists in a big town, and it is more worthwhile to attend a large event than a small one. Things have changed. The Port Townsend Film Festival and Port Townsend itself have shown that small can provide more enlightening and pleasant experiences.
Everyone is together. There's no paparazzi over here, a line for special people here, and then the great unwashed. Everyone is mixed together here in a way that is really satisfying for filmmakers.
The Port Townsend Film Festival takes place September 23rd through September 25th at locations in and around downtown Port Townsend. This is Charlie Burmant for KPTZ Port Townsend. I'll be right over, gonna take you to the movies tonight.
We'll begin by talking with Margaret Wilson. Hello, Margaret.
Hello.
You are the author of Sea Women of Iceland, Survival on the Edge, which I think is what brings you here to the festival. Is that right?
It is indeed, yeah.
Yes. And also author of Dance, Lest We All Fall Down, Breaking Cycles of Poverty in Brazil and Beyond, a long ways away from Iceland. And you are a professor of anthropology at the University of Washington.
I am associate professor, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, you get around from Brazil to Iceland, but you started your life somewhere in the countryside of Oregon.
I did indeed, yeah. Small town life in Oregon.
And how did you manage to get from there to the London School of Economics to the University of Washington? In brief, because, as you know, time is short, and we want to talk about Iceland for the most part.
You know, at 18, not knowing anything about the world, I took off on working on boats and went off the South Pacific, actually.
Working on boats doing what?
I'd worked in boats when I was a teenager, and then I started crewing and went to the South Pacific, and then I worked as a deckhand on boats, and eventually made my way back to the States and went to Western.
Western Washington University.
I did indeed. And from Western Washington University, I got accepted to the London School of Economics to do a PhD.
You must be kind of smart.
It was a culture shock. I felt as though I was hanging on my little fingernails. It's like, oh dear, I read the Cliff Notes, and these people have read all the literature in the original language.
So what led you to the study of seafaring women in Iceland? Did you go to Iceland just because you wanted to see volcanoes and you discovered the history, or did you know of it before you went there?
No, I didn't. I think so much of our life is just serendipity and strange chance. There was a woman I'd met who was an Icelandic, who was an oceanographic physicist here in Seattle, and I had a house in Seattle. I was trying to pay the mortgage, so she was sharing my room. We became extremely good friends, and she invited me to go visit her in Iceland. And I thought, I'll never have this chance again. And it's these weird, small decisions that can be life-changing. That was it.
So Thuridur Einar's daughter?
Einar's daughter, yeah.
Ooh, you say that so well. Say the whole name for us.
Thuridur Einar's daughter.
You practice the language there too, huh?
I do, but Icelanders still say I have a terrible pronunciation.
But do you speak fluent?
Oh, no. Not at all. My reading is better than my speaking. Most Icelanders speak English, so that makes it hard to practice.
Tell us about this woman whose name you can pronounce and I cannot.
She started fishing when she was 11. She wanted to go out. Her father said she could go out, and she immediately started catching fish. And it was just open rowboats, wooden rowboats they were in. And she quickly became so good, they gave her the traditional sea jacket and mittens from 11. And she was catching more than anybody else very rapidly. she was very well known because she was so smart, and she was so good with the crew, and she also caught the most fish, and she could read weather so well. In her 60 years of fishing, she never lost a single crew member, which is huge in Iceland. And she also became a detective because her powers of observation were so good. It's amazing.
What years are we talking about?
She was born in 1777, and she lived until 1864.
And just to be sure that people heard that or know that you didn't misstate, the years again,
1777. That's what's so remarkable as well. At that time, a full third of the fishing fleet in Iceland were women. That's one of the remarkable things that I discovered.
How did you learn this?
With my fantastic Icelandic research assistant going through dusty tome after book after book after book and tons of archives, and it just started finding more and more. And then there was a fantastic Icelandic woman, Thorin Magnusdóttir, who did research in the 70s, way ahead of her time, and she discovered the same thing that I did. But nobody's read her stuff much. Iceland is amazing that they were a completely literate country from like the 1400s or earlier, whereas the rest of Europe, most people were illiterate. So you had all these people, you had lay farmers who could also write, who collected the stories of everybody in their area. And so, unlike most other countries, they have a written record of their common people. And if the people who wrote them were mostly men, and if those men felt that women were important enough to put in the history, then you have verbatim accounts of women from the 1700s, even 1600s, saying what it was like to go to sea. And wow. In their words. It's amazing.
And what was it like to go to sea?
Well, you know, it's tough.
Their boats, for example, they rowed.
They were...
How big were they?
It depends. They could be, I think in terms of tons, but they were 20 feet. They had 6 oars, 8 rowers. They were undecked, just round-bottom boats. You just put the stuff underneath them. They were fully exposed to all the weather. So if they didn't have the proper leather clothing, they would die. Because they're in the Arctic.
Which is, a lot of weather up there.
Oh, yeah. The number of people who drowned is just astonishing. That's one of the reasons, the ways you find, I found out what percentages of women were in the boats is reading the death records, where you see that a huge percentage of the people who drowned alongside the men, you know, is women.
And you said in 60 years of fishing, she never lost anyone.
She never lost anybody. So she became renowned for this. And it got, for instance, in one experience where she came in before the other boats did, and tragically this storm came up and some of the other boats were lost. And it was very close to shore. That was the terrible thing with these terrible surfs. So people on shore could watch their loved ones die in front of them. She made it in because she saw the weather was going to shift. Another time she went out when everybody else thought the weather was terrible. It calmed, so everybody went out then. So it became that all the other boats would watch her and follow her either in or out because she had this remarkable weather reading ability, yeah.
And they were fishing for what, and what technologies did they have in the 18th century for catching the fish, whatever
right.
the fish were?
They were a colony, so getting anything was incredibly difficult. Most of the people were mostly very close to starvation. They had very few possessions. What people had is they just had a single line and tackle. And because twine was so valuable, so hard to get, that you had your own tackle. And that was one of your very valuable possessions. And you kept that. And also there was a lot of superstition. If your line was lucky or not, this is the one that I caught a lot of fish on. The commercial fish has always been cod. That they would salt the cod eventually. And then it was very popular in Europe and other ways. There was another fish that a lot of the people just caught because it was close to shore, called grasleper, which it's called a lumpfish. It's a weird round fish, and they would catch that to eat. It's a very fatty fish, but they didn't do that commercially, but everybody ate it.
Do you find that the superstitions, is that all gone away? Is that just history now? I mean, what elements of that culture remain that
what
identify
was, If you're thinking of superstitions, for example...
Well, like the lucky tackle, for example. I mean, is it still,
Well, fishermen are about some of the most superstitious people on the planet. I was going to say, what do you mean gone away? You're talking to me. You think I'm not superstitious? Come on.
Do you fish, Margaret?
I don't fish sport fishing, but I've done commercial fishing.
And you never left port on a Friday, did you?
Exactly.
Absolutely. And the 13th exactly. would be even more deadly.
All these things.
Craziness, and that is all true. The crews that this woman, whose name you can pronounce and I cannot, commanded were mixed men and women?
Yes.
There was no issue with that, as far as you could tell?
No, there wasn't. The superstition against women, well, this is fascinating, I felt. You can read the records, and by the late 1800s, there's a creeping in that women shouldn't be at sea, they should be on shore. Before that, there's none of that. Women are just expected, they're very much applauded for their incredible skills at sea, just the same as men. And then it's only in the late 1800s, I think, as they start getting, it was so isolated, as they start getting more influence from Europe, that first is women shouldn't be at sea, and then you see the superstition that women aren't lucky at sea creeping in. Whereas previous to that, women were actually considered more lucky than men, particularly at sealing, hunting for seals. Women, particularly pregnant women, that was the best.
That was what I was wondering about.
That's
it. Is there a prohibition against pregnant women?
No, not even today. All these women, they go, well, I didn't tell my father, or I didn't tell the skipper or whoever, because, of course, they're just concerned at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
But they disguise it for as long as they can. There's a woman she's been at sea for 40 years, and she's a qualified large vessel skipper. She fished until she was 8 months pregnant. Many of them do, actually, until the crew kind of says, look, you got to get off. And they go, oh, okay.
We don't have a midwife on board.
Exactly. It's a bit of a problem. Although there are old histories of women who are out there who, I've got in the records of these women going into labor, just barely making it. One woman actually gave birth at sea, just barely making it, having the child as they pull the boat on shore.
These times in Iceland, are women 50-50 represented in the fishery with men?
No, ironically enough, gender equality has not gone up as the years have gone by. It's gone down. In the 1900s, they got pretty well pushed off sea, crawled their way back on during World War II, got more and more and more in all positions. But since 2008, with the economic crisis, there's a huge competition for the jobs, and it's now, intriguingly enough, more difficult. One thing that I think is very cool is this book, because Icelanders themselves, the women were completely invisible, this book has caused a great deal more attention to women and their contributions to the sea in Iceland, and I'm hopeful that it'll open the doors again for them more. It's pretty exciting to be in the position.
So your
intriguing
book, Sea Women of Iceland, is available probably through the normal channels, Amazon, University of Washington Press, and where else?
Well, it's available at most bookstores.
Uh-huh.
Or you have to ask for it. It's a small independent press, University of Washington Press, so it's not going to be one of those that they get paid to put on the front tables. But, yeah, everybody's got it.
Our timekeeper, just looked at his watch. Tim Snyder, who is our next guest, just walked up. That means we're going to have to say goodbye to Margaret Wilson. Margaret,
yes, thank you so much. This has been really fascinating.
It's been wonderful talking with you and meeting you.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, see you again, I hope, soon.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And the 13th of October, you will be at the Imprint Bookstore, 7 o'clock, with your book, Sea Women of Iceland.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing people there. Thank you again.
Have a good festival.
Our next guest has joined us, and welcome Tim Snyder. First, I just want to give a little introduction to Tim Snyder, who is not only one of the founders of this festival, but apparently was the founder or one of the founders of Wooden Boat Magazine, which has been a major reference, I think, for wooden boat lovers for decades now. And
thank you, Steve. Yeah. These are all wonderful words. Let's start at the beginning, which is I would like to thank 40 years of volunteers who have made this event possible. And without the people who are working here all around us and have always been around us, we wouldn't be able to have this festival or the first one. I came here in 1977 looking for a place to have a wooden boat festival. And I had been looking around the United States, and many places said, no, we don't want a bunch of boatniks here.
But I understand that meant something different from a boat show to you.
Yes.
That...
No. This whole idea began really with those of us at Wooden Boat Magazine in the middle 70s, who, when we went to boat shows in Newport or Rhode Island or Annapolis, we heard stories from people who were trying to rescue some broken boat, and they didn't know how, they didn't know where to get materials. And our mantle at the magazine was to put in written form the information on how to do that and maybe some guide works. But in graduate school, before that, I'd been part of a symposium where I saw that if you had a gathering with experts and that people came, that you could actually sit down and have a long discussion about whatever it was you were interested in and get some real answers. So that was kind of my formatting, and I began to draw up the idea of a festival.
And you were living in Connecticut at that time?
I was living in Connecticut and working in Maine at Wooden Boat Magazine, which began in a cabin in the woods with a phone on the tree. And there were four of us, and I ended up liking to get out of Maine, so I became the person who went around and set up boat shows all over the country and met with people who had ideas and desires, and it really underscored the idea that it was needed a place to have people meet, see great boats, and see experts doing what they dreamed of doing.
And I gather that you really traveled around and looked at lots of different places before you settled on Port Townsend. So, I mean, what was it about Port Townsend that made you say, this is the place?
Are you being paid by the chamber? Well, in 1976, I gave my proposal to Mystic Seaport, which, if anybody has not been to Mystic Seaport or have an opportunity to go to Connecticut, is the finest maritime museum that we have in the United States, with wooden boats of all sizes, the Herreshoff collections, many, many, many things, and archives. Is wonderful. And that inspired me because I've been doing that since I was a kid, going there. And so when I first saw Point Hudson, I said, yes, this is the place, and maybe someday we might even be a mini Mystic. Now, as I look out at what I see around me, I see we don't have to be a mini Mystic because we are here at the Northwest Maritime, and with this festival, a full-fledged world-class player.
We're Port Townsend.
With Port Townsend. And it was just a stroke of luck because I had attempted to start the festival in Anacortes, and Sam Connor, who was a boat builder here in the shop just down the way, was there, and he said, well, before you sign up with Anacortes, would you please come over and look at Port Townsend? And I came over and looked at Port Townsend. I saw this harbor. I got off on the old ferries, the really good ones, the steel electrics that docked right there at the Town Tavern, both of which are no longer there. And Sam said, I can get you this harbor, and you can use my wood shop, and I'll help. And that's how the festival began.
Now, I understand that Port Townsend was really quite a different place in those days.
And Lake Wobegon.
And Point Hudson was...
Lake Wobegon. Think Lake Wobegon. There was not even a stoplight downtown, and you shopped at J.C. Penney and Western Auto. And it was a simple, kind town, a place that was really 1938, and people had discovered that you could come here and live in an old Victorian house. And it was an era when you could buy a Victorian house for a couple thousand dollars.
And the docks were wobbly and rotten. How did you keep people out of the water? Or did you successfully keep people out of the water?
Well, we were younger then, Phil.
You've already told us that. We know that. We know that. But they were crowded. And you did not expect the crowds. I know that the numbers of people who came exceeded your expectations. But I remember it being a little dicey down on the docks.
Ah, yes, well. Were the docks safe? I don't think we cared. We just were really focused on the demonstrations that were going on here. We had people come from all over the United States who were experts in different kinds of boat building and the trades of boat building. And so the workshops were packed, and the boats that came were really dressing. I mean, they were fantastic. They still are fantastic.
About how many boats and how many people came to that first festival?
Well, the first one we expected 800, and 3,000 came.
Wow.
The second festival, we thought, well, gosh, maybe we'll get 3,000. And 8,000 came. and those shows were the size that these are now. The festival today.
Did that overwhelm you? I mean, 8,000 people, was that?
No, because
that didn't sink the docks.
No, not that.
Or the porta potties.
Well, people have referred to that as the Woodstock of boats, and so there was a spirit of communality and of working together, and those little issues were overlooked. I suppose we didn't have insurance and we didn't have lawyers around looking about liability, and thank goodness.
How you said that you went to some communities on the water and they did not receive you warmly. How did you present this initially to Port Townsend? I have read and I have heard the sensibility that it was a bunch of hippies coming trying to sell an idea. But you actually were a bunch of pretty ambitious people.
We brought people aboard who were known in the community. The volunteers were all the community, and so they saw that was going on. It didn't really make a dent until the actual festival, when the city fathers saw that all the rooms were booked, all the restaurants were sold out, and my gosh, there's lots of buying public here. And then all of a sudden, the Chamber of Commerce came chasing for me and said, "Please, Tim, will you join the chamber?" What I like to think of is that, you know, I birthed a child, not knowing that that was happening, and then over the years, I've been able to watch the child grow and stumble and carry on and become a person you're proud of now, and someone who never got in trouble, never got busted, and never wrote home for tuition checks.
That actually raises a question I had, which was about financing. I understand at first that there was no admission at the first festival.
No, that's wrong.
Right? Is that not true?
No, it was more academic, where everybody who paid and wrote in had a typed up badge, and we all had badges on with our names and maybe where we were from, so that people talking to each other could see who they were, could see who the names were. And it was
That's
person to person. And so you knew who the name of the person was that you were talking to.
So who were some of the stars of the first show? And how did you get them here?
Down the street here in that white building, I had a desk and a telephone and a typewriter. And for 4 months, I called and I wrote and talked to people who I knew were people that would be wonderful demonstrators and would they please come. And I got in the car and drove around the state of Washington and personally invited Earl Wakefield and personally went to Tacoma and saw Joe Trumbly, who was a master at the Bates program there.
I understand that phone number is still the phone number of the Maritime Center.
That's correct. That's correct. You know, as we grew, Sam Connor couldn't have it back.
Well, so one of the things that the festival has been credited with actually has been the amazing growth of the marine trades in Port Townsend. That, you know, like the festival attracted people here who then stayed.
Well, absolutely. And when word of the festival came out, and partly that was my fault because I write stories in Wooden Boat Magazine, people in the Wooden Boat community all over the country said, "Wow, that might be a place." And you've got the wood, you've got the people, and many, many immigrated here without passports. But there was an existing body of people who had great skill here, who had always been here and who were living simply and quietly and didn't want much notice. I told Sam Connor about our talk today, and he didn't want the notoriety. He's hiding from the microphone.
Well, we're making him notorious anyway.
Something that I've never done.
Certainly have not, Tim. And I want to thank you for coming.
It's my great pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for the festival.
Oh, thank everybody.
You've been listening to a reprise of excerpts from last Saturday's live broadcast directly from the docks at the 40th annual Port Townsend Wooden Boat Festival with co-hosts Phil Andrus and Steve Evans. A podcast of the entire two-hour program can be found on the kptz.org website. For KPTZ Community Radio News, I'm Steve Evans. This week's KPTZ Compass was produced by Steve Evans with segment producer Charlie Bermant. Phil Andrus and Steve Evans co-hosted the live broadcast from the Wooden Boat Festival, with field engineering by Bill Putney and Mike Carroll, and field producer Robert Ambrose. Mike Schlexer was the studio engineer. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.